Your energy, said Rebecca, flashing a double thumbs up. Ruby let her head loll back and pretended to hang herself. Chapter 9. It wasn't a kind first thought, and it wasn't a very hopeful one. But it drove Elizabeth slightly bonkers to think that Jane was going to profit from Zoe's foresight and investment and commitment. That was marriage, agreeing to share bank accounts and bookshelves, even when you didn't want to, even when it made things messier in the case of an eventual split. In her years as a real estate agent, Elizabeth had come across several couples with separate checkbooks, which seemed like a red flag. Too cold-blooded, too pragmatic. It was like announcing that you hadn't decided if you were going to stay married or not. Take me, take my overdraft charges. Take me, take my embarrassing number of books with teenage vampire protagonists. Elizabeth had never considered the alternative. It was as bad as signing a prenup. Why bother getting married, going through with all the pomp and pageantry, if you didn't think it was going to last? It was far easier to live in sin and not have to deal with the paperwork. She knocked on the door. Zoe was on the sofa reading a magazine and waved her end through the window. Elizabeth opened the door and glanced up. The ceiling in the vestibule was cracked and needed a new coat of paint. Looking at the house was easier than looking at Zoe and telling her what was broken and needed fixing. They had always been close, in college and even more so in the years after, when they'd lived together inside these very walls. But after marriage and crawling children, there wasn't an easy way back. Like many, their friendship had slipped a disc somewhere along the way. Yes, sure, they would sometimes have dinner, just the two of them, and then they'd have a big talk about everything in their lives, but that was only once every 3 or 4 months. Their friendship was still there, but it also felt like it was a million miles away, viewable only through a time machine and a telescope. "Do you want to talk?" Elizabeth asked. It had been her idea to come over. Zoe had expressed some interest in knowing what the house was worth, just in case. "Do you have a piece of paper? I want you to write it all down so you can talk to Jane about it, about what needs to be done, okay?" Elizabeth had been in the house 1,000 times, more maybe. Had lived here, had slept on the couch, had thrown up in the toilet. She had a good idea of what needed to be done, but she needed to show it all to Zoe. It was impossible to really see a space when you'd lived there for so long. All the eccentricities began to seem normal, the way you'd never properly rewired the doorbell, and so you had to push it extra hard to the left. The way the guest bedroom was 2 different shades of cream because, well, why was it? It was a mistake, just a part of life. But now someone else was going to buy that mistake, and that someone was going to offer $100,000 less because of it. Elizabeth was in her work clothes. In Manhattan, the agents wore outfits that looked like they could double as evening wear, tight black dresses and heels. Luckily, no one in Brooklyn wanted that. It made people uncomfortable, that much gloss, but she still had to step it up a notch. Her biggest concessions were ditching her clogs for a pair of flats and putting on actual pants in place of jeans. It was important to show respect for the fact that people were plunking down their entire life savings for 3,000 square feet. Sometimes, because it was New York, people spent all their money on 500 square feet. That's when Elizabeth wore heels, when she felt a little bit guilty.
"You look nice," Zoe said.
"I had to," Elizabeth said. She dusted off her blouse. "I have a closing today, a house up in Lefferts." She wondered how bad she normally looked. Her hair was straight and naturally blonde, which is to say a light, innocuous brown, and cut short just below her ears, with little bangs like a schoolgirl's. She liked to think that she looked like a gamine, but that probably wasn't true anymore, if it ever had been.
"Hmm," Zoe said, not really listening. "Shall we begin the processional death march?"
No one was ever interested in the business part of Elizabeth's job. All anyone ever wanted to know was if she found people's sex toys or whether the sellers were getting a divorce. No one wanted to buy bad juju. If she were a better liar, Elizabeth would always have told prospective buyers that the sellers were retiring and moving to Florida after several happy decades in whatever space she was trying to sell, with entirely redone mechanical and electrical systems. That's what people wanted, the promise of a satisfied life with very little work to do. Of course, no one in New York City was ever satisfied. It's what kept her busy. Even people who liked where they lived kept an eye out for something better. Shopping for a new place to live was easier than shopping for a new husband or wife, and less traumatic than going into analysis. They started on the ground floor,
The kitchen was old but sweet, with a nicely expensive stove, well used. Hausstraubers would be impressed, even if the cabinets hadn't been painted in 20 years. The dining room needed paint, too, and less furniture. Jane had stacks of chairs in all four corners, in case of an impromptu dinner party for 30, which Elizabeth knew they often had. The living room was okay. Ditch the family photos, the vintage knickknacks they'd so lovingly acquired at yard sales. Ruby's piles of clothing everywhere. The staircase needed a little love. Nails were poking up all over the place, and the skylight on the landing hadn't been cleaned in a decade. Upstairs, all the bedrooms needed paint jobs, and Ruby's needed a hazmat expert. The two bathrooms were pretty terrible, but not worth doing. Throw out the mildewy curtains, get all the dog hair off the floor. Whoever came in with that much money was going to want to do things their way. Elizabeth and Zoe stopped in the master bedroom.
"You want to talk about it?" Elizabeth asked.
Zoe sat on the edge of her bed, which was low to the floor and rumpled. Bingo padded over and sat down on her feet.
"It's been coming forever," she said. "You know that. After Ruby was born, I didn't think we'd last 2 years. Then, when we opened the restaurant, I thought we were done for sure."
She ran her hands back and forth over Bingo's stomach.
"But then when Hyacinth started doing well and Jane was always there, it didn't seem as pressing. How sad is that? We were too busy to split up."
"So why now? Why do it?" Zoe wasn't the first to get divorced. Slowly, Elizabeth and Andrew's circle of friends had come closer and closer to the national average. At first, it was just one couple, then another and another. Now, half of Harry's friends had parents living apart from each other, and the kids bounced back and forth like tennis balls. Andrew sometimes expressed worry about it, whether Harry was absorbing some of that stress and angst from his friends, even though it had never seemed like an issue.
"The last time we had sex was in January."
She paused. "Last January."
"Sex isn't everything," Elizabeth said.
She took another look at the bed that Zoe was sitting on. It looked like the bed in a hipster hotel, streamlined and Danish, a more expensive IKEA model. Zoe's choice, clearly. The kind of bed where people did nothing but have sex, or maybe read each other some translated poetry. Zoe had always had scores of lovers at school and afterward. She'd had women chasing her down streets and out of dance clubs, throwing their phone numbers at her like so much confetti. Jane had sleep apnea and sometimes slept with a special mask that Zoe said made her look like the villain in a science fiction movie. And yet it was Jane who had stolen Zoe's heart at a bar, the kind of place where you were supposed to meet one-night stands, not wives, and Jane who had stolen her from Elizabeth. Zoe shook her head.
"It's not nothing.
I don't know. I think we both finally came around to the idea that we could be happier apart. It's one thing to be in a lull, but it's another thing to stare down the next 30 years of your life and just be filled with depressing fucking dread. I don't know if it'll really happen, but it sure seems like it." She gave Bingo a few good pats on his head.
"As long as this guy comes with me, I'll be fine."
"Okay, so we need dog-friendly."
That ruled out certain buildings in the Slope and Cobble Hill. It was easier to think about Zoe and Jane this way, in terms of concretes, especially in an area where she could really help. Zoe needed her. It was nice.
"Dog and old queer lady friendly, yes."
"Easy."
Elizabeth leaned against the wall.
"So, where would you want to move? Would you want to stay in the hood? Leave?"
They'd been pioneers in Ditmas, planting the flag before the neighborhood had any decent restaurants or a good public school or a bar with a cocktail menu. Before tree guards, before block parties with bouncy castles.
"God, I don't know. I mean, why am I here, right? It was sort of random, and now it's home. But I don't care about the outdoor space or a stupid lawn. That's why people move to the city. I want that. I want to move somewhere where I can walk to a good movie theater by myself at 9 o'clock at night and eat pad thai and buy jewelry on a whim. Does that exist? I want Ruby to think it's cooler than wherever Jane goes."
"Jane's talking about moving into a studio above the restaurant. She'll be a monk until she finds someone else to be her housewife." Zoe flopped backward onto the bed.
"I need a massage, and some acupuncture, and a yoga class."
"When did you guys do the roof?" Elizabeth ran her finger along the windowsill, gathering dust. The view was almost exactly the same as from her own bedroom, only a few degrees shifted. She could still see the Rosen's place, with its red door and folding shutters, and the Martinez house, with its porch swing and the dog bowl. She'd heard once that what made you a real New Yorker was when you could remember back three layers. The place on the corner that had been a bakery, and then a barber shop before it was a cell phone store, or the restaurant that had been Italian, then Mexican, then Cuban. The city was a palimpsest, a mod podge pileup of old signage and other people's failures. Newcomers saw only what was in front of them, but people who had been there long enough were always looking at two or three other places simultaneously. The IRT, Canal Jeans, the Limelight. So much of the city she'd fallen in love with was gone. But then again, that's how it worked. It was your job to remember. At least the bridges were still there. Some things were too heavy to take down.
5 years ago, maybe?
Shit. It's okay, Elizabeth said, turning back to face Zoe, who had covered her face with a pillow. It's okay. Chapter 10 Harry's room was painted dark purple, and it was a little bit like sleeping inside a gigantic eggplant. He could have asked his parents to paint it another color, but it didn't really matter, seeing as the purple only peeked out here and there between the edges of the posters and other things he'd taped to the walls. He was going for one complete layer, like the people who got tattooed over their entire bodies, even their eyelids. Harry didn't care about everything he'd put on the walls, but at some point he'd cared enough to put it all up there, and he respected his own process. It was okay to grow out of things and keep them around. He liked being reminded that he'd been obsessed with Rugrats and Bart Simpson, and, for a few inexplicable months around his 13th birthday, Kobe Bryant. He didn't even like basketball. Mostly the walls were covered with pages ripped from magazines and things he'd printed out, pages from books that he'd copied at school. It was like Tumblr, only 3D, with no scrolling. The narrow strip of wall next to his closet was completely covered by pictures of sandwiches. Teenage girls got all the credit for being angsty and weird, and it wasn't fair. Even at Whitman, which was supposed to be progressive and artsy, the boys bragged about the time they went to a shooting range with their grandfathers in Connecticut or Virginia. They wanted to learn how to drive and listen to hip-hop. Harry wasn't interested in any of it. Luckily, his father wasn't the kind of guy who insisted on things. Everything Harry had ever done was because he wanted to, like the child sultan of a palace with only two servants. Going to one school from age 5 to age 18 was like being buried in amber. It wasn't even like his walls, which were covered with layers of things. You had to be the same person from start to finish, with no big cognitive jumps. Harry was quiet and sweet and did his homework. He had three close friends, two boys and one girl, and he wasn't particularly fond of any of them. He didn't vape or drink malt liquor, because there were other kids who did that and he wasn't one of them. He had smoked weed a few times, but he knew that his parents did too, so it didn't seem that bad. Harry lived in a monastery built of his childhood likes and dislikes. His parents loved it, and he never got into trouble, and it made him want to scream. His phone vibrated in his pocket. "Come outside." It was from a number he didn't have in his phone. Harry walked over to the window and pulled the curtain to one side. Ruby was leaning against a parked car, holding her phone over her face, with her giant dog leaning against her legs. Harry's parents were in bed, or working. Their bedroom was upstairs, and his mother often worked late at the small desk in their room. "Be right there," he texted back. Harry changed his t-shirt twice, and then tiptoed down the hall. The route to the front door was creaky, but clear. "What's up?" Harry said once he was a few feet from Ruby. She hadn't moved. Her hair was spread out over the passenger side window like big purple jellyfish. Bingo sniffed genially in Harry's direction. "Walk with me. My moms are being total dicks." Ruby pushed herself back to standing and pulled Bingo's leash in the direction of the park. Harry put his hands in his pockets and followed. She pulled a pack of cigarettes out of her pocket and stuck one in her mouth. "Want one?" she said through her teeth. Harry shook his head and watched Ruby cup one hand around the end of her cigarette and flick a lighter with the other. He was amazed at how brazen she was, smoking on their very own block, where they knew the people inside every house, all of whom could have picked up the phone and called her mothers. Very few kids at Whitman smoked. It wasn't like when their parents were young, when everyone had packs of ciggies in their back pockets instead of cell phones. Now everyone understood about lungs and cancer and how the tobacco companies were trying to appeal to youth. It seemed borderline pathetic to give in, not that Harry could have thought that anything Ruby did was pathetic. It looked bad on other people, was all. The small contingent of smokers at school went around the corner to do it, or crossed the street and sat on benches in the park. Harry had never smoked a single cigarette. He'd actually never been offered one before. That was how small Whitman was. It wasn't even a question. Harry Marks didn't smoke. It was a fact. They walked 3 blocks straight up Argyle until they hit the soccer fields and the back of the tennis center. It was dark, and the park was closed, but there were still a few people kicking around a ball.
"Rebels," Harry said, and Ruby laughed.
They crossed Caton Avenue and walked into Prospect Park proper. Harry didn't like going into the park at night, even though there were always people running or biking around the main loop. It just seemed like one of those things that people did right before something bad happened to them, like running upstairs instead of out the front door in a horror movie. At least they had the dog with them, even if Bingo was geriatric and had permanent tear stains under his sad eyes. Ruby nudged Harry toward the bridle path, a soft dirt road that went a little bit farther into the park than Harry would have liked, but she moved with such confidence that he didn't want to be lame. Bingo seemed to know where they were going. Finally, after a few minutes, Ruby plopped down on a bench. They were completely alone, staring out at the lake.
"People fish here. Have you seen that?"
Ruby asked. She lit another cigarette, and this time didn't bother to ask Harry if he wanted one.
"You can pay me $1 million to eat a fish that was born in Brooklyn."
"I'm pretty sure no one is paying anyone $1 million to eat anything that was born in Brooklyn," Harry said.
He watched the red end of Ruby's cigarette move up and down to her mouth. It got brighter when she inhaled, and for a second, Harry imagined that he was the cigarette, his entire body. And when she drew the smoke into her lungs, he felt himself slip inside her throat and slide down into her body. He felt the softness of her lips and the thick velvet of her tongue.
"So that SAT lady is pretty bad, huh?"
Yes, Ruby said.
She gripped the cigarette in her teeth and pulled her hair to one side and wove it into a thick braid. "She's a fucking psycho." Bingo opened his mouth in a wide, stinky yawn.
"Speaking of psychos, has Dust called you? Do I need to hire a bodyguard?"
Harry tried to make his voice sound as light as possible, but he had been worried. Dust seemed like the kind of guy who had a lot of scary-looking friends who knew how to do things like get into fights, which Harry definitely, definitely did not.
"Oh, he's totally harmless," Ruby said. "I'm pretty sure."
"What about your mom's?" Harry said.
There were ducks in the lake, swimming from one side to the other, and Harry wondered when ducks slept and how long they lived with their parents. Then he wondered if kids who grew up in Manhattan thought ducks were mythological creatures, like cows, things that existed only in picture books and in cheese commercials. Or maybe they had ducks there, too, in the park. There were some kids at Whitman who took the train from the city every day, which seemed beyond stupid, like walking up the stairs to the top of the Empire State Building. There were easier ways to accomplish the same thing.
"They're probably getting divorced. I don't officially know that yet, but I know your mom does, so maybe you do too."
He didn't. Ruby shrugged. "It sucks." Harry had heard his mother tell his father about Ruby's mothers, but he hadn't been told directly, and so it was easy enough to pretend.
"I didn't know," he said. "I'm sorry."
"It's their marriage, not mine," Ruby said. "I'm a modern girl. I know it's not my fault."
"Still," Harry said.
"Still,"
Ruby allowed. She took another drag.
"Can I have some?"
Harry asked. Ruby cackled.
"Oh, shit," she said. "I thought you didn't smoke."
She held it out to him, upright like a candle.
"I don't," Harry said.
He plucked the cigarette from between her fingers and put it up to his lips. The filter felt rough against his tongue. Was he supposed to lick it? Probably not. Harry inhaled. He had smoked weed before, after all. He wasn't a total noob. The smoke flooded his lungs, sharp and harsh. He coughed once and tried to swallow a few more, which just made him cough harder. Ruby hit him on the back. The dog offered a sympathetic snuffle.
"Ride that pony," she said, laughing. "Ride it."
Harry thrust the cigarette back at her, but she waved him off.
"No way," she said. "Not until you tame that beast."
Harry waited for his breathing to return to normal and for his eyes to stop swimming. And then he tried again. Chapter 11. In the age of the internet, when his son couldn't walk 3 steps without checking his phone, Andrew appreciated a Xeroxed advertisement stapled to a telephone pole. Usually it was just ads for the nerdy guy who taught guitar lessons or for lost dogs or cats, but Andrew always looked. He was between jobs, between careers, if you wanted to be specific. There was enough family money that he didn't have to worry too much, plus the royalties, plus Elizabeth's income. And so Andrew had spent his adulthood to date following his inspirations. A decade ago, he'd taken a cinematography course at the New School and had worked on some short films, including one about an abandoned mental hospital in the Palisades. Before that, he taught English as a second language at a high school in the Bronx, but that had only lasted a year. More recently, he'd been working on a lifestyle magazine for Brooklyn Fathers, doing some editing and soliciting, but mostly acting as a consultant. It was good to be around younger people, kept the blood flowing. Next, Andrew thought he'd do an apprenticeship at a butcher shop or with a woodworker, something with his hands. His usual routine was to get up with Harry and Elizabeth, send them off to school and work, and walk down to Cortelyou to get some coffee. Now that Harry was out for the summer, Andrew felt like it was even more important to keep busy. He ordered a small coffee and walked back out onto the street. Ditmas Park was great in the summertime. The sycamores and oaks were full and wide, leaving big pools of shade along the sidewalks. Families were on their porches. Kids were throwing balls around and learning how to ride their bikes. Neighbors waved. Andrew ambled to the corner and waited for the light to change, feeling happily aimless. Harry would stay in his room for much of the day, taking SAT practice exams or playing video games or reading books, bless him. Even though that was the point of parenthood, to raise smart, happy, self-sufficient people, Andrew mourned the loss of the days when Harry cried out, "Daddy!" every time he walked in the door, even if he'd only been gone for 10 minutes. Andrew was staring into space, thinking about Harry's 2-year-old body, the hugs he would give at night before bed, when a flyer stapled to the pole next to the crosswalk caught his attention. It was a drawing of a lotus flower, like the logo of a yoga studio, with hand-drawn petals. Underneath the flower, large block letters spelled out, "We are here, are you?" Below that, there was just an address on Stratford Road, 3 blocks from where Andrew was standing. No hours, no phone number, no website. "Huh," Andrew said. He thought about ripping it down so that he could hold on to it, but that would look bad. He didn't want any of his neighbors to see. They'd think he was either for or against it, when he didn't even know what it was. Instead, Andrew typed the address into his phone and crossed the street. It was definitely going to be woodworking. The more he thought about it, the more sense it made. Butchering would mean vats of blood, saws, bones. Andrew wasn't squeamish, and he loved the idea of knowing more about where his food came from, but a rooftop vegetable farm was probably more his speed. That didn't appeal, though. Vegetables took too long. Andrew had always liked a simpler equation. He wanted to see the payoff before an entire season had passed. When he and Elizabeth met, he'd worked in the school's bike co-op, fixing old beaters that careless students had left locked outside over the summer, and he'd loved his dirty, greasy hands at the end of the day. The spinning wheels. Woodworking, carpentry, would be like that. He would have calluses and maybe burns. He would whack a fingernail by accident, and it would turn black. That was just what he was looking for. He'd build a desk for Harry, a new pair of end tables for their bedroom. Maybe they could do it together. Elizabeth's professional problem was the opposite. Instead of Andrew searching, she had the answer but chose to ignore it. It was a lost cause at this point, though he did coax her to start playing again by saying that he wanted to do it. She would do it for him, he knew, but not for herself. His wife was a true talent. Unusual, smart, gifted, all the words that places like Whitman love to throw around to describe perfectly ordinary students. But Elizabeth wasn't ordinary. She was incredible, and she had stopped playing for such practical reasons, as if practicality had anything to do with it. Instead of turning right and walking back home, Andrew turned left and walked to Stratford. He never walked in that direction. It was toward the gas stations and the one bar that had recently opened that he hadn't been to yet. Come to think of it, the bar wasn't that new anymore. It was probably a year old, but he still hadn't been. Andrew turned right on Stratford and walked another block. He was now parallel with his own house, only 2 blocks east. The house had once been white, but was now the color of dirty city snow. The windows were old. Andrew could tell just by looking at the outside. He'd learned a lot about houses from Elizabeth, what to look for. Together, they'd been inside most of the houses in the neighborhood. The steps were sinking in the middle, and the floorboards of the porch were cracked. It wasn't a hard fix, but it would be expensive, especially if they got soft enough that the mailman fell through and decided to sue. Andrew hovered for a minute on the sidewalk, not sure what he was going to do. He should go home and start his day. Zoe knew a guy who built things, some kid from Maine who lived in the neighborhood and built dining room tables for people on Cobble Hill and Brooklyn Heights. Andrew was going to give him a call. The door to the house was open, and Andrew could see another flyer taped above the doorbell. He took one step toward the house and then stopped. He could see a man inside. The guy had a beard, not quite ZZ Top, but heading that way. It was impossible to tell how old he was. The man turned toward the door, saw Andrew, and waved as if he'd been expecting him. Andrew waved back, then climbed the stairs to introduce himself.
"Welcome," the man said.
From close up, he looked younger than Andrew had thought, maybe not even 40. His beard was speckled with red and gray hairs, like a duck egg that was so beautiful and complicated that you couldn't believe it just happened that way, with no intervention from a design team.
"I saw your poster," Andrew said.
Inside, the house itself was nothing special. Sort of falling down, really, but the floors were clean and painted white, as were all the walls. The thin curtains were pulled to the side, and light came pouring in. Andrew immediately felt at home.
"This is Evolvement," the man said. "I'm Dave. Come on in."
He spoke softly, the way that people did when they knew others were going to listen. There was no reason to speak loudly, not in this house. Andrew got it right away. This was calm. This was a sanctuary. He thought about the monks he'd seen in Tibet and upstate when he'd gone for silent retreats. This was one of those special places, or it was going to be, and right here, in his own neighborhood.
"What can I do?"
Andrew asked. His hands were empty. He wanted to help. Chapter 12. Hyacinth sat 42 people. On a good day, the restaurant was half full at lunch and then busy from 6 p.m. until 9:30 p.m., with stragglers hanging around the long, narrow bar until 11 when they closed. Even 10 years after opening, Jane couldn't charge what she wanted to charge. No one would pay $27 for skate this deep in, but she got by. There was a small desk right next to the hostess stand, and that's where Jane liked to sit when she wasn't in the kitchen, or upstairs in the office, or downstairs checking the walk-in, or walking the floor, which the servers hated. Jane had to wedge her body in between the wall and desk to keep from getting elbowed by the hostess, but she didn't mind. She had sous chefs now, good people whose taste buds she trusted, but there was no substitute to being in the room herself. Jane liked to sweat and to yell, and there was no better place to do that than in a tiny restaurant kitchen. Elizabeth had found the space. They had looked for months, waiting for the right place, and Elizabeth had taken it on like her own little pet project. They didn't just look in Ditmas, though that's where they wanted, of course. There would be less foot traffic, but they both loved the idea of helping make the neighborhood a place where people wanted to live, not just sleep. Jane and Zoe had fallen in love eating food, talking about food, about what they dreamed of eating down the block from their door. Zoe was old-fashioned and wanted to open a French bistro, somewhere to eat steak frites at night and soft eggs during the day. Jane wanted to do Thai, or better yet, Vietnamese. There was nothing in the neighborhood but pizza and a Chinese place with bulletproof glass in front of the cashier. There were so many holes, and they wanted to fill one. They'd looked everywhere, in Williamsburg and Carroll Gardens. Nothing was right. But when Elizabeth called and said she'd found the space, Jane could hear in her voice that she was right. She and Zoe walked over holding hands, giddy. Hyacinth was one of their girl names for when Ruby had a little sister. But Ruby was already in first grade, and it didn't seem like she was going to get a sister after all. So Hyacinth went up on the wooden sign and got painted in gold leaf on the door, and they were open for business. Jane was in charge of food, and Zoe was in charge of everything else. She picked out the chairs and the water glasses, the flatware and the floral arrangements. She did the payroll and the billing. She dealt with the staff, which was the worst part of owning a small business. Someone was always getting fired or showing up late, or hitting on too many customers, or on drugs. As long as they didn't need money or sleep, life was easy. Ruby's babysitter would bring her straight to Hyacinth after school, and when they couldn't afford the babysitter anymore, Ruby would come on her own and sit at the bar with her homework. Elizabeth and Andrea would pat her on the head, and she'd join them for some French fries. The regulars loved it, their own little Brooklyn Eloise.
After dark, Zoe would take her home and put her to bed, and then come back if they were really in the weeds. They had an elderly neighbor who fancied herself the mayor of Argyle Road, and both Jane and Zoe felt sure that she would never let anything bad happen to Ruby while they were out. It was early, just after 9. They didn't open for lunch until 11. Jane shut the window with her menus and her lists for the purveyors and opened the internet. She wasn't really looking for a new place to live, not yet. Once Ruby left, wherever and whenever that happened, and when Zoe found a place she liked, then she'd look. If it really happened. Jane wasn't in a rush. If it were up to her, they'd stay married forever. So what if they weren't as happy as they'd ever been? They were adults with a nearly grown child. Happy was a word for sorority girls and clowns, and those were two distinctly fucked up groups of people. They were just wading through the muck like everyone else. At 24, Zoe Bennett was the sexiest thing Jane had ever seen. They met at Mary Mary's on Fifth Avenue, a proper lesbian dive bar that was always full of service professionals, especially after midnight. Jane went 2, sometimes 3 times a week, and rarely did more than drink beer with her friends. But one night, this electric little nymph shows up at the end of the bar, pirouetting around like she owned the place. And by the end of the night, she did. Jane was working as a garde-manger at the Union Square Cafe, and Zoe was a hostess at Chanterelle. They didn't even talk that first night. Jane swore that Zoe fell onto her lap while singing along to a Bonnie Raitt song on the jukebox, but Zoe didn't remember doing any such thing. They were both lushes, ready to eat and drink until the reservoir was empty and the lights were on. 3 weeks later, Jane moved in. The bell over the door rang, and Jane looked up. Johnny, her UPS man. He wheeled in a tower of boxes, paper towels, toilet paper, all the things she never wanted to have to think about. That was Zoe's job, keeping them stocked and ready for the apocalypse. They hadn't figured that part out yet. What about Hyacinth? It would be strange for Zoe to keep doing her job, but it would be stranger for her to stop. Everything was in both of their names. They didn't need to be married for them to keep working together, of course, but what if Zoe started sleeping with Allie, the adorable hostess? They always joked about her, about how she was in love with Zoe. But now, if she were single, what if it were true? Jane could see it so clearly, peeking out of the kitchen and seeing Zoe touch Allie on the back, or tuck her hair behind her ear. Maybe Jane would fire her before Zoe got the chance. She wasn't great at her job anyway. It wasn't part of Jane's job, dealing with personnel, but she was the chef. Everything was her job, really. "Hey, hey," Johnny said. He nodded toward the supply closet. "Want it over there?" "Please," Jane said. She wasn't just talking to him. She was beseeching the universe. When Johnny was gone, she locked herself in the bathroom and cried. It was the only room with a door that locked. She told her mother that they were considering splitting. Not any friends, not the staff, no one else. Jane thought that if no one ever found out, it might not really happen, the way they didn't tell anyone that Zoe was pregnant until she was 4 months along, or like when Jane was 16 and knew she was gay but didn't come out until she was 20. If it really happened, her parents were going to be crushed. They'd always loved Zoe, her mother in particular. Maybe Jane could avoid talking to them entirely for a few months or a year. Maybe they didn't have to speak until Ruby got married, at which point they might be 80 and hard of hearing and not fully understand. Maybe she could wait until they were dead. Someone knocked on the door to the bathroom.
"Yeah,"
Jane said. She stared at herself in the mirror. She was over 50, with moles she'd been meaning to get checked out and a lone chin hair that sprouted up again every time she plucked it. Life was a fucking disaster, but it was time to organize the lunch prep and to call the butcher, and so Jane unlocked the door. Chapter 13. The Mary Ann O'Connell Realty Group was a boutique firm with just 5 agents. Elizabeth was the only one who didn't have the last name O'Connell. In addition to 83-year-old Mary Ann, there were her 2 children, Sean and Bridget, plus Sean's wife, Deirdre. The office was on the corner of Cortelyou and East 16th Street, half a block from the rumbling Q train. Elizabeth and Deirdre shared a desk, which Elizabeth had always found a bit odd, that Sean would rather share a workspace with his sister than with his wife. But the O'Connells were nothing if not odd, and so it was to be expected. Family businesses were deeply complicated organisms, and it was almost always best to stay as far away from the decision-making processes as possible. Elizabeth would happily have worked from home, as she had when Harry was young,
But Marianne got nervous when she didn't see her crew hard at work or hear the jingle of keys as they left for a day of showings. Her office was in the back, and the door was never closed. When you came in or went out, even if it was just to get a sandwich, Marianne's white corona of hair would begin to vibrate slightly, like a rung bell. Deirdre liked to joke that her mother-in-law had been struck by lightning as a child, and the jolt reappeared whenever she thought she was about to make money. She also liked to joke that the only reason she and Sean were allowed to get married was that on paper she, born in Trinidad, sounded as Irish as he did. Deirdre was the only O'Connell whose company Elizabeth actually enjoyed. It was a glorious day outside, not yet the full summer warmth, but balmy enough for people to bare their arms and legs without the fear of goose pimples. Those windows of time were so short in New York City, which was and always a place of extremes. They thought about leaving, for that reason, among many others, but the steadiness of California's 72-degree days didn't appeal either. It was good to have things to complain about, to build character. Elizabeth leaned back in her chair and admired what she could see of the day through the window. The three desks were arranged by seniority, which meant that Elizabeth, a company veteran of only a decade, was sitting 3 feet from the sidewalk outside. Sean walked in from lunch after a morning full of showings. Early summer was always their biggest season, and inventory was high. The bell tinkled, and Elizabeth heard Marianne start asking Sean questions before he'd passed fully through the doorway. He nodded a greeting at Elizabeth and kept walking into his mother's office. Elizabeth's cell phone rang, and she answered without looking at the caller ID.
"Hello?"
she said. There was a pause, then a click. "Holding for Naomi Vandenhoevel?" a young woman on the other end said.
"Excuse me?"
Elizabeth said. She put a finger in her right ear to block out a fire truck roaring down the street.
"Hello?"
"Lizzie," another voice said. "Thank you so much for speaking with me. I so appreciate it."
"I'm sorry, who is this?"
Elizabeth swiveled her chair away from the window, the whole office dotted with sunspots. "This is Elizabeth Marks," she said, wondering if someone had called the wrong Elizabeth, scrolling quickly through the E-section of her contacts.
"Elizabeth, it's Naomi Vandenhoevel. I've been in touch about the rights for the Lydia biopic. I work for the studio. We've emailed."
"Oh, Naomi, yes," Elizabeth said. She turned back around and opened her email, frantically searching for Naomi's most recent missive.
"I've been meaning to get back to you."
"Listen, Elizabeth, I know it seems crazy, after all this time, to just sign over the rights to your work and to your story, but this is a go picture. Do you know how hard it is to get a movie made these days?"
There was a whooshing sound.
"Sorry, I'm in my car. Let me close the window."
"But how did you call me from your car? Your person just had me on hold."
Elizabeth was asking a serious question, but Naomi only laughed.
"I know, right?"
she said. "Anyway, we really need the song. You know we need the song, and the life rights. I know that sounds scary, like life rights, but it's just a fancy term for agreeing for there to be a character who may or may not have anything in common with you, really. I can give you a few more weeks to work on your husband, but that's really it. They want to start shooting in the fall."
"Don't you want millions of teenage girls to go to the movies and see some badass fucking chicks playing rock and roll, like, wow, the whammy bar or whatever, you know? Don't you want to be an inspiration? Forget about Lydia. Just think about a girl in the middle of nowhere who thinks life is sucky and boring, and then she sees this movie at the mall, and she goes and buys a guitar and starts writing songs in her bedroom."
Elizabeth closed her eyes. She hadn't been able to talk to Andrew about Lydia at all. He'd gone to extraordinary lengths to avoid the conversation. He'd booked dentist appointments, taken their otherwise neglected car in for an oil change. This imaginary girl in her bedroom, though, that might work. Her life saved by music, by the movie, by them. It was certainly working on Elizabeth. She felt tiny tears forming, as suddenly as with a truly excellent Kleenex commercial.
"I'll try.
I'll send over the forms again. The world needs to see this story and to hear your song. Anecdotally, it's my favorite song of all time. I'm sure you hear that a lot, but it's true. I have the chorus tattooed on my ribcage."
"You don't,"
Elizabeth said, though it wasn't the first time she'd heard of such a thing. Once she'd seen a whole slideshow of them on BuzzFeed.
"I do," Naomi said. "I'll send you a photo."
"You really don't have to," Elizabeth said.
"Oh, I want to. It looks fucking great."
Elizabeth's email dinged, and she swiveled around to look. Sure enough, there was a ribcage with the words, "I will be calm, 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 calm," in cursive.
"Wow,"
Elizabeth said.
"Wait, how did you just send that? Aren't you driving?"
"I was so tanned this summer, it was sick," Naomi said, ignoring the question. California was a terrifying place. Anyway, sign the forms and get them back to me as soon as you can, okay? Thank you so, so much.
I will, Elizabeth said, not meaning to agree, but just that she'd let her know. She was nothing if not polite.
Harry was always teasing her for calling to cancel restaurant reservations or appointments at the Apple Store Genius Bar.
No one cares, Mom, he'd say,
but Elizabeth believed in courtesy. She waited for Naomi to say more, but realized she was already gone. Chapter 14. The garage was unfinished, unlike some of their neighbors who had converted the spaces into playrooms or offices and put in plumbing and heat and wood floors. Andrew and Elizabeth had the old-fashioned kind, with rusting shovels and half-empty cans of paint. They pulled the car in only when huge snowstorms were expected. Otherwise, the large center of the space was empty, with a rug from Andrew's parents' house and two creaky wooden chairs. Elizabeth's small Marshall amp was on her side, and Andrew's boxy orange amp was on his. Andrew rolled the garage door high enough for them to walk under, and then slid it halfway back down to the ground. People walking along the sidewalk could see their legs, maybe, but only if they were really looking, and there were far more exciting things to look at. Middle-aged rock and roll hobbyists were about as thrilling as old ladies gardening, and significantly more embarrassing. Andrew knew how things looked. He had his notebook with him. He'd been writing things down, not whole lyrics, but ideas for songs. Elizabeth was much better at making things sound good. She had a notebook full of lyrics, too, or at least she used to. Now her notebook was filled with this couple or that's likes and dislikes, their contingencies, the size of their bank accounts.
Want to play that one from the other day, the bum-bum-bum-ting one? Elizabeth asked.
She settled into her chair and pulled her guitar onto her lap. She plugged it in and slid the strap over her shoulder. Andrew loved the way his wife looked with a pick between her teeth. It went straight to the very essence of him. Once, in high school, his history teacher had gone on an epic tangent about how Barbara Stanwyck was his sexual profile, and everyone got extremely creeped out, but that was how Andrew felt about women who played the guitar. It didn't matter if they were really good or really bad or just holding one. If they could really play, forget it. He was done. It was deeply sexist, and so he'd never said it out loud. That was what Oberlin had been good for, teaching him that most things men thought on a daily basis were rooted in sexism. But it was true. With Elizabeth, it wasn't just that she could play, but that she was really fucking good at it.
What?
Elizabeth said, the pick still between her teeth.
Nothing,
Andrew said. He grabbed his bass by the neck.
Sure, let's play that one.
Actually, honey, I meant to tell you, the people called about Lydia again.
Elizabeth puckered her lips.
Can we talk about it? We're supposed to let them know soon.
A garbage truck clattered down the street, its brakes squealing every 30 feet. Andrew let go of his bass and ran his fingers back and forth through his hair.
I just don't like the idea of signing a piece of paper that hands over the control to some giant corporation. Next, it'll be in a Kleenex commercial.
I'm pretty sure that we can stipulate exactly how they can use it, Elizabeth said. The movie is about Lydia, not about us. They don't care about us, honey.
She leaned the smooth back of the guitar against her sternum.
That's exactly my problem, Andrew said. You didn't write those words for Lydia to sing. We didn't write that song to have teenage girls in the mall in New Jersey pretend to be punk.
You mean like teenage boys who grew up in Manhattan pretended to be punk?
She rolled her eyes. Pot. Kettle.
It was the 80s! I wasn't pretending! I was fucking angry! The fact that my parents were Reagan-loving demons had a lot to do with that. Come on, Lizzie.
Andrew crossed his arms over his chest and took a few deep breaths.
I just don't want to contribute to some soft-focused portrait of Lydia Greenbaum as some kind of folk hero. Why should we help them?
Because they'll give us money?
Are you really that cheap?
Elizabeth felt the words as acutely as a slap.
Excuse me? Andrew, I understand that you and I feel differently about this, but the fact that I'm willing to get paid a very healthy additional fee for work I did 2 decades ago does not make me cheap.
Harry is going to go to college, you realize, soon. This house needs 12 new windows. Our basement is a resort for cockroaches.
We could use this money. The Marks Family Trust doesn't have to pay for our lives, you know. I'm not being greedy.
She started to sweat.
And it's not just about Lydia, you know, or us, even. It's about being inspiring to young women, to girls who feel like maybe they could play music, too. Like that girls' rock camp or whatever.
When they met in Ohio, so far away from their families and from their real lives, there was no way to tell that Andrew had money and that she didn't. Everyone was exactly the same. They all wore thrift store clothes and carried bags from the Army-Navy supply shop. Elizabeth had always thought her parents' house was normal, nice even, until Andrew reluctantly brought her home for a visit during their senior year's winter term. They drove Elizabeth's car. Andrew didn't have a license, nor did he seem to have a sense of how to get around. He kept directing Elizabeth to go one way and then cursing when he realized he'd sent them in the wrong direction. They spent an extra hour driving in circles in New Jersey before finally finding the Lincoln Tunnel, then another hour crawling through traffic to the Upper East Side. Elizabeth drove with her shoulders hunched over the wheel, looking for a parking spot on the quiet, dark streets.
"This is where your parents live?"
she'd asked when he'd pointed out the building. It was on the corner of 79th and Park Avenue, with a giant metal sculpture of a cat out front. They lugged their bags into the lobby, all marble and spotless black countertops. A doorman with a cap hurried to help them and greeted Andrew by name.
"Yeah,"
he'd said, mortified. That night, when they'd curled up together on his childhood bed in a room that overlooked Central Park, he told her how he fantasized about running away, about hopping on trains or sleeping on a bench in Tompkins Square. At Oberlin, Andrew majored in religion and was doing his senior thesis on Hindu goddesses. He wanted to move to Nepal. He wanted to sleep on the floor. He told Elizabeth over and over again how little his parents' wealth mattered to him. And when she said that she was hungry, he called a diner on Lexington Avenue and had them send over scrambled eggs.
"I'm sure your parents have eggs in the kitchen," she'd protested, but Andrew insisted that the diners were better.
Elizabeth thought about those eggs on an annual basis, if not more often. Still warm and, yes, delicious. And how they told her more than Andrew ever could about how he'd grown up. Sometimes even the brightest people had truly no idea.
"We don't have to decide today," Elizabeth said, shaking her head.
"You play. I'm going to make lunch." She put her guitar back on its stand, clicked the amplifier off, and walked out of the garage. Chapter 15. This time, Eliza and Thayer didn't even pretend to say hello to Harry. They turned, saw him walk in with Ruby, and continued their conversation with no visible break. Rebecca, their fearless leader, was shuffling papers on her makeshift desk beneath a projection screen. Thick blue mats that the karate school used to teach people how to not get murdered by ninjas were still out, and a few kids in the class were doing somersaults.
"Oh, they're totally getting into Harvard," Ruby said.
"I think that one looks more like a Yaley,"
Harry said, pointing to one guy who had toppled over onto his side.
"Maybe Princeton."
"Barf," Ruby said.
This was the only way that Ruby would talk about the future. She knew that Harry must be wondering why she was taking the class. No one took an SAT prep class for fun, especially not after their senior year. But Ruby never volunteered any information. She made fun of everyone who was going to good schools, but she also made fun of everyone who was going to big party schools and everyone who was going to tiny liberal arts schools. It was open season on everyone but her. It wasn't anyone's business. So what if she'd applied to 8 schools and not gotten into any of them? It didn't make her a bad person. It made the admissions committees look like idiot snobs who deserved to be covered in honey and walked into the bear cage at the zoo. There wasn't even really a point to going to college, not anymore, not for her. The thought of sitting through another 4 years of bullshit lectures about things that happened in books that were written hundreds of years ago was the world's biggest waste of time and money. Ruby's personal essay had been to that effect, and it appeared to have accomplished its goal. If either of her parents had thought to proofread her applications, they might not be in this pickle. She'd written the essay half as a joke, but then the joke had turned into her actual life. Ruby was sure that someone would stop her eventually. When she clicked the button to send in her applications, knowing what the attached documents looked like, Ruby kissed college goodbye. She wasn't surprised when the applications were all rejected. At first, her mothers didn't even know, because they were waiting for letters to show up in the mail, not realizing that nowadays letters only showed up if the news was good.
"Wait, that's actually the best idea," Ruby said.
"What is?"
Harry asked. They were standing 4 feet inside the door. Rebecca clicked on her computer, and a drawing of the cat taking the SATs popped up on the projection screen. Ruby folded over herself, her hands clutching her stomach.
"Oh, no," she said,
Rebecca, I really need to go home. I think I'm going to throw up.
Thayer and Eliza turned around, their mouths open. Harry folded over in sympathy.
Are you okay?
He said, their faces both upside down. Ruby winked.
Is it okay if I make sure she gets home?
Harry said, righting himself. Rebecca hustled over with some handouts. Ruby made a sound, dark and low and rumbling, that sounded like an approaching subway. No one wanted to see what was on that train.
Of course, Rebecca said, pulling the corners of her mouth down into a cartoon pout. Feel better, okay?
She patted Harry on the back. Ruby grabbed onto Harry's wrist.
We have to get out of here right now or else I'm going to puke all over the dojo, she said.
What belt would that get me? Harry let her lead him out the door. Ruby kept moaning until they'd crossed Church Avenue and rounded the corner. Even though they were now out of sight, Ruby went over to a waiting mailbox and pretended to vomit into it, complete with sound effects. Then she stood straight up and took a deep, graceful bow. Harry looked at her with awe, and Ruby saw the rest of her summer in his face. He could be her project, her hobby, her doll.
I'm hungry, she said. Do your parents have food?
Your parents own a restaurant, Harry said.
Which is exactly why they never have food. I can tell you right now what's in the fridge. Yogurt, 3 different kinds of fish sauce, and pate.
Ruby had once searched online for a support group for children of those in the food service industry, for kids like her who'd never been allowed to eat milk chocolate or Cheese Whiz or marshmallow fluff or the extra-sweet supermarket peanut butter, but she hadn't found anything.
I think we have some chips and salsa, Harry said.
That'll do.
The living room was empty when they walked in. Harry called out,
Hello?
But his parents didn't respond. It was 9:40 a.m.
My mom's got some open houses, I think, Harry said. I don't know where my dad is.
Whatever, Ruby said, and walked straight into the kitchen. If he comes home, just tell him that I got sick and that your house was closer, so he came here.
Like 50 feet closer?
If you're barfing, 50 feet is a lot of feet.
I guess that's true.
Ruby loved being in other people's kitchens. Her mothers were such total freaks. The salt had to be a special kind of salt, unless it was for baking, in which case it had to be some very particular kind of normal salt, that sort of thing. Elizabeth and Andrew were just regular. They had Diet Cokes and a giant block of orange cheddar cheese. Ruby took the jar of salsa and the bag of chips off the counter. You want to go to your room?
Sure,
Harry said. Iggy Pop slowly climbed down from his perch over the refrigerator, and Harry scooped him up and held him like a baby. Ruby walked past the two of them toward the staircase. Ruby hadn't been upstairs in the Marx's house since she was little, but not much had changed. The walls were still a very pale orange, like a melted popsicle after a rainstorm, and the same pictures were on the walls. There was one painting hanging by the door to Harry's bedroom that Ruby had always liked, a village scene, with a Japanese woman watering some flowers in one corner and some free-range chickens in another. The Marx's house was always neat. Everything had its place. Unlike Ruby's mom, who came home from every trip with some colorful trinket to put on a shelf to gather dust forever and ever, Elizabeth and Andrew seemed to have no useless objects. Ruby wandered down the hallway, poking her head into rooms.
My room's over here, Harry said, behind her.
I know, Ruby said, still walking.
What's this? She stopped in front of an open door, the smallest room in the house.
It's the guest room,
Harry said. The couch folds out, plus it's just like storage, I guess. Ruby walked in, and over to the metal shelving along the wall. There were big, clear plastic bins, each of them labeled. She ran her finger along the bins.
Wow, your mom is kind of OCD, huh?
Harry shuffled in after her and sat down on the couch, his hands in his lap. Iggy Pop, who had darted up the stairs after them, jumped into his lap.
I don't think so, he said. She's just organized.
Is this what that looks like? Ruby asked. Oh, shit, wow.
Harry stood up quickly, sending Iggy back to the ground.
What, is there a mouse?
Ruby turned around to look at him, her purple hair flying.
Why would I say wow if I saw a mouse, you weirdo? No, look, it's all Kitty's mustache stuff.
She pulled one of the bins on the top shelf down to the floor and unlatched the lid. The box was filled with stuff. Flyers and cassettes and 7 inches and posters and zines and college newspapers with reviews of their shows. Ruby leafed through the pile on top and pulled out a glossy photograph.
Check this shit, she said.
From left to right, it was a picture of Lydia,
Andrew, Zoe, and Elizabeth. None of them smiled or looked at the camera. Her mom was wearing a suede jacket with fringe and had a cigarette dangling out of her mouth, like a pissed-off movie star who'd just come back from a bender in the desert. Elizabeth was wearing a floor-length black skirt with dark lipstick, her then-long blonde hair tucked behind her ears, her body pointed toward the rest of the band. Andrew wore a white shirt and a flannel tied around his waist, his hair curling past his shoulders. Lydia was sitting cross-legged on the ground, holding her drumsticks and an X over her head.
"What is this from?" Harry said, taking the picture out of Ruby's hands.
92, Ruby said, pointing to the date in the corner in Elizabeth's handwriting. OCD.
"They're so young," Harry said. "It's kind of horrifying. Look at my dad's jeans and his hair."
"Look at my mom's boobs," Ruby pointed.
Zoe wasn't wearing a bra, and her nipples were clearly visible, even across time and space and this many years. Harry covered his eyes.
"And look at Lydia."
It was weird knowing that your mother had had a life before you were born, but everyone had to deal with that eventually. Everyone's mother had had sex at least once, and lots of people's mothers had gotten drunk and been wild. Ruby knew she wasn't alone. But it was extra weird to know that your mother had been drunk and wild with someone famous. And not someone famous for no reason, like the stars of a reality show, but someone actually famous and important because she was really good at what she did and people loved her. Ruby pretended that she didn't care about Lydia because she knew that her mom would find it annoying, amusing. Her mom would have thought it was adorable. That was the worst fate of all, for your parents to look at you with their parent eyes and to call your inner turmoil cute. Zoe would have loved it if she knew that Ruby had Lydia's two solo albums on her phone and that she listened to them when she walked down the street by herself, that they made her feel invincible and angry. But there was no way in hell that Ruby was ever going to tell her. Ruby shuffled through the stack of posters and photos on top. There were a few more of the band, including one with Lydia standing in the middle with her mouth open in a scream, the rest of the band standing diagonally behind her. Unlike the others, this photo actually looked like Lydia. The real Lydia, the Lydia whose face would be taped on bedroom walls and printed on T-shirts.
"Do you know how much money we could get for this on eBay?" Ruby said.
Her mom sometimes sold her old clothes on eBay, vintage dresses she'd had for decades and finally decided she didn't need.
"No," Harry said.
"Well, good thing you have me," Ruby said. Her hobby was paying off already. Chapter 16. Andrew had waited until Harry left for his class and then slid his feet into his rubber-bottomed slippers and walked quickly to Stratford Road. This time he didn't hesitate before walking up the stairs and into the house. The sign was still outside. "We are here. Are you?" But now Andrew knew the answer. He was. Dave was in charge, if anyone was in charge, but it wasn't that kind of place. Evolvement was a co-op, and everyone who lived there worked there, too. It wasn't about ownership or hierarchy. It was about people and mindfulness. A young man with a beard and skinny legs said hello and offered Andrew a cup of tea.
"Is Dave around?"
Andrew asked.
"Have a seat wherever you like. Make yourself comfortable," the man said.
Normally, Andrew would have been annoyed that the guy hadn't actually answered his question, but that was how things worked around here. He got it. There were stacks of cushions on the floor. Andrew took one, plopped it down next to a wall, and sat. He was happy to wait. A few other young people flitted around quietly, all of them in bare feet. Andrew pulled off his slippers and tucked them under his knees. After a few minutes, there was some laughter at the top of the stairs, and then Dave was walking toward Andrew with a huge smile, like he'd been expecting him.
"Nice to see you again, Andrew," Dave said.
He was short and stocky, like a gymnast, densely packed. Dave lowered himself down next to Andrew and touched him on the shoulder. They were only a few inches apart, as close as you'd be to a stranger on the subway, but in the big, open room it felt remarkably intimate, as if Dave had stroked Andrew's cheek with the back of his finger.
"Sure,"
Andrew said. He felt himself blush a little bit.
"I'm interested."
And he was. Andrew was interested in philosophy and the mind-body connection. He was interested in getting out of his own house and his own brain, seeing if he could link up to something outside, like the cables that ran between houses. He was interested in channeling his anger into something else, into a color, into air, into positivity. It was that kind of talk that Andrew's parents hated.
They didn't give a shit about process. They only cared about the bottom line. His whole childhood had been wasted that way, bouncing from one